bit. Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
The Escape Pod on Joy and via podcast at joy.org.au/escape pod.
You're in the Escape Pod on Joy 94.9 with Russ Masterton, Mark Adams, who of course has been missing in action. We don't like it when we have a musketeer.
We're back to three, you. Everyone.
And Joe Pryor. Yes, the three musketeers are all in the studio, so watch out this afternoon. It's just going to get steamier in the Escape Pod. We have today in the studio a special guest.
A very special guest.
We do.
A très special guest.
I think, Mark, you've not done an introduction for so long.
Today's guest is here to talk about, it was from the French department at Melbourne University. Bienvenue, Diane de Saint-Léger.
Thank you.
You have a very special topic to talk about and a very timely topic to talk about. Let's hear about what you're doing and what your exhibition is all about.
Well, it's about somewhere in France. This is the title of the exhibition. Somewhere in France, Australian on the Western Front. Mm-hmm. And we launched that exhibition at the University of Melbourne on Thursday night. And this exhibition...
That were the fireworks I could hear.
Oh, yes. It was with a big loud bang. this exhibition is there to commemorate the centenary of the arrival of the Australian soldiers on the Western Front, so in France and in Belgium. So it was in March 1916 when they arrived, or thereabouts. So we made sure that we could turn this exhibition to actually pay homage and explore a little bit what it meant for the soldiers that came to France and explore and live there for several years.
Married.
Yes, it was a long-term commitment. I mean, it was a war of attrition. It wasn't over as quickly as everybody was thinking it would be.
But it was 6 months on a boat to get there. So
it did, but I think it's part of that journey, which was quite special and amazing in many ways in relation to Australian soldiers, because they left from Melbourne. Some of them actually went to Gallipoli and fought, and fought in very difficult conditions, as you know. Then they were located in Egypt waiting for further orders. And some of them stayed for many months before they knew where they were actually being sent next.
Well, Lawrence of Arabia was trying to give them a heads up, but no one wanted to listen.
That's right. So, those soldiers actually eventually made their way to Marseille, to the south of France, by boat. So it was indeed a very, very long journey. And some people actually have described Australian soldiers as the soldiers as a tourist as well. Not that obviously it was the ultimate purpose, but it was definitely a very important part of the journey, and they felt compelled and entitled to discover the world. And this is what we're trying to explore a little bit in this exhibition. So we're moving away from the battlefield, we're moving away from the fights, the artillery, and all
the technical aspects.
Technical and military aspects. I mean, many of the people have told that story already, and they've done it so well that, and this is not really our focus anyway. What we want to explore, rather, is what soldiers, and Australian soldiers for that matter, did away from the battlefield. So what did they do when they weren't fighting? And actually the fights, even though they were very, very violent and horrible, and we know all that, but there were many, many moments where soldiers were kind of idle and they had to keep themselves busy, and that's also a story that is seldom told. And the military army really knew about that as well. Boredom was the enemy in many ways. You didn't want soldiers to think too much about the condition and the hardships they were going through, so there were many ways to keep them busy. And you can also trust Australian soldiers to find many ways to keep themselves busy as well.
I mean, it must have been the ultimate adventure for someone who is 18 years of age and has never seen anything other than Australia.
Wangaratta.
Exactly. Or, or Horsham or Woi Woi or anywhere of those places to actually leave country, end up in Egypt of all places, and then in beautiful Marseille in France. I mean, for them, it must have been the just mind-blowing.
Although the Western Front, I don't think at that time you could call it the most beautiful part of Europe.
Well, you would be surprised.
It's pretty rainy.
You would be surprised because they arrive in March, actually, when they arrive.
Ah, okay, spring.
Spring. And they're coming from several months in the Egyptian desert.
Heat.
So it's hot, It's sandy, it's horrible conditions, in terms of living conditions.
Yeah, tents and flies and mosquitoes.
And they do arrive in Marseille. Camping. Yes, camping, most definitely.
What would Marseille have been like in...
Oh, it was a very busy port. And obviously, you know, the maneuvers and the logistic behind it would have been quite complex. And there were, lots of things that had to be done before soldiers could get off that boat. I mean, just think about the tropical disease and the pests and all the various things they could bring with them. I mean, mind you, they did experience many other pests while they were on the Western Front. So the rats, the fleas, various disease, mice, you name it. But anyway, from Marseille, they actually took the train up north and they actually discovered the countryside that was not that section of France that was at war. And everything was green, blossoming.
Lavender.
See the Alps, further.
And near Switzerland. Stopped. So did they go past Mont Blanc?
Yes, it did.
Mm. And we're picturing the aerial views of the Tour de France right now.
Yeah.
Well, actually, yes.
Tour de guerre.
Yes. And, they stopped in those stations and you had all the population. I mean, obviously, you had the local population there to welcome the soldiers.
But there would
back.
Have been different food. There would have been different smells. There would have been
different wine.
An overload of the senses, really.
Dan, tell us about the University of Melbourne French Department. What do you do?
What do I do?
It's
right.
Probably pretty descriptive in the University of Melbourne French Department topic.
No, that's title. Okay. What I do is, or what we do as a team, I mean, there's a whole lot of us. We actually look after students and we teach them French, as you can imagine.
University level French?
University level. So we've got students that are actually coming at all level of proficiencies. So when you come to the University of Melbourne, you can actually start a language as a beginner.
Oh, okay.
So you can start any language, but French is one of them.
As I did with Latin.
Yeah.
Really?
As a beginner, yes.
You could no challenge there. My God. Oh, good to
you. Yes, so you can definitely start as a beginner.
That's right. So you can start as a beginner or, you might have done some French at some point, typically secondary students who by year 10 realize that it's all too hard because we all know that learning a language is actually really hard. I mean, I don't know if you've ever tried or if you ever persevered.
We all speak another. Yes. Joe lived in Japan. I lived in Germany.
We all tried.
Yes. Yeah. So I think, at secondary school, people always try to make language fun because that's how you kind of catch students.
And it's not, it's a harrowing set of rules and failure.
Well, you can look at it that way.
And ridicule and humility.
You can look at it that way. But at the end of it, when you are able to interact and, use the language in a range of settings, whether it's professional or for traveling purposes, you kind of have this deep sense of satisfaction. So, yeah, it takes perseverance, discipline. It's hard. It's ungrateful, but it's really fun eventually. Anyway, so ask.
And it's all about conjugating verbs in French, isn't
no,
it?
No, it's not.
Wait, there's more?
There's more.
Maybe the literature?
You've got the literature. You've got the culture in general. Mm. You've got, so many domains you can explore, whether it's, even history, political science, cuisine. Mm. We've got a subject called Matters of Taste that explores the various connection between food and identity. So there are many various ways and fascinating ways to actually explore a French or any language for that matter, but just not only through the conjugation and the verb. Those days are slightly over.
How did the department then get the opportunity to curate and stage this exhibition?
That's a good question.
Collaboration, how did that come about?
Well, it came about because I was really interested in developing a subject that really focused on a specific moment in time. I wasn't really sort of set on that moment, but a specific moment in time where you had this very strong or special French-Australian connection. And really, it all started at the Melbourne Shrine in the city, to be completely honest. I took my two young boys there and I discovered how important this Western Front had been for in a history, in a military history of Australians. And, you know, I mean, at the
it's
time I was telling you...
It's considered a touchstone.
You,
I mean, it is presented as, in our Australian history, how we became Australians and acquired an identity.
Yes.
Separate from Britain.
That's right, in an international sphere. And from there, of course, there came all of these things that now are in popular parlance by certain politicians, such as mateship and things. So it really it's how we defined an identity in the world context.
Yeah, most definitely. But I suppose at that time anyway, I mean, of course, I knew, you know, about the history, but in public discourse, Gallipoli was taking prevalence, and the whole memory and all that collective discourse about the importance of the World War One was attached to Gallipoli, and rightly so, of course.
And also to a white Australian experience. We really didn't explore the Indigenous Australian soldiers' experience as much, and Gallipoli was overwhelmingly taking that story from an Anglo-Saxon Australian point
that
of view.
Is so true, and I think maybe if there's a really good side about revisiting what it means, what this period of history means via the centenary is that lots of those untold stories are slowly unraveling and are being explored by scholars that have a genuine interest about the various groups that took part in the fight or in the combat, and of course the role of women as well. I mean, there's many different ways you can look at it, and it's really a wonderful opportunity from that point of view to the centenary, that is, to really rediscover or reinterpret or re-explore things that we kind of thought we knew. And so to go back to the project and to what I did with my students initially, I sort of kind of worked with that thought, and then I discovered, one thing leading to the other, that the Melbourne University Archives had actually a wonderful collection of archive materials, letters, correspondence, postcards, memorabilia that had been given or acquired by the archives over time, and that it was extremely easy for me to use this material with my student and to do something with it. And then the question is, well, actually, these are produced by Australian soldiers in English, and it's a French class. So how do I work with that? And so with my colleague Katie Wood from the archive, and we worked in team, and I suppose that was also what was really important and interesting about that project, is that various departments started to work together in ways that are maybe a bit unusual.
Oh my goodness, collaboration.
Collaboration at a university, my goodness.
And a very successful one for that matter. So
you're starting up a new League of Nations.
Yes,
100 years later.
Looks like it. Looks like it. So we did an online exhibition, basically, and students had to present this archive material and present it in French.
Are these undergrad students? Are they postgrad
students?
No, they're
undergrad students. Mm-hmm. So they were in the second and third.
History students?
Mainly art students, but in our department, you've got lots of students that are also taking a language as what we called breadth. So, for instance, they would be doing science or architecture or
their elective is
and it's one of the electives, so which is quite interesting as well, because students come with a interest, and those that are interested in science could look at the doctors at wars or various other topics, or engineering for that matter.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You know, I can remember my first trip to France, which was, I was about 22, and my French was shocking. And I just am trying to put my shoes into the feet of these young servicemen arriving in Marseille. And, you know, I would just get flustered, and I'd be screaming out, speak English, I can't understand what you're saying. And but from an Australian perspective, what do you think that they learnt before they arrived in Marseille? Were they actually taught how to speak French and to anything about French culture at all?
Oh, well, that's a really good question.
Yes, they listened to the Rosetta Stone podcast.
They actually had no French whatsoever. Most of them really sort of you know, arrived and they just got by. So what's also really interesting in relation to the soldier as tourist that we were talking about before is that not only you've got this long journey and this journey starting from Australia all the way to France and then across France, but you also had all those little tools that you would have as a tourist today. So you had phrase books and you had language books, and those phrase books were not about, oh, part of it was about military stuff, I suppose, but most of them was, I'm thirsty. What time is it? Can I please have another blanket? Because those soldiers were
actually... Voulez-vous coucher avec moi ce soir?
Well, this one, I think they knew. I trust them. Yeah.
It's the first one.
Yeah, that and Sa plan pour moi.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That
oh, there's an old favourite.
We should play that.
But, yeah, so those soldiers were really sort of in the midst of it, and they were completely outside their comfort zone. And but at the same time, they really embraced it and they really took everything they could to make the most of it, if I can say so. So when they were on leave, they would go to Gay Paris, as they would call it. Mm. They would go to London. They would go to various places in the south of France. And they used their pass and their leave to, you know, it was a bit this attitude of, I must seize the moment because first I'm here and plus... my next battle, I might not be around anymore. So there was this really thirst for discovery and for exploring Paris. And
adventure.
Adventure, most definitely. And also seeing the world and experimenting with various things. And when they came to Paris, you know, they would do all the sightseeing, the Champs-Élysées, the Arc de Triomphe and the Louvre and, you know, many other places like that. But they were also really amazed at all the cafes, you know, that was new to them. It didn't exist in Australia at the time. So you've got lengthy description about them, you know, walking down the boulevard and looking at all those apparently fashionable people. Oh, that's how they describe it, you know, with all the usual cliches. And it kind of makes it for a very interesting read, even now when you know, you've got trench magazines even that are supposedly developed by soldiers for soldiers. But within those trench magazines, such as Aussie magazine, for instance, you had special sections that were written to guide soldiers whilst they were discovering Paris. And of course, it was untitled, you know, you had to have a bit of a quirky title. So it was called Leave Making in Paris. And that was a chance for them to, you know, be told where to go. And they would go to Folies Bergères as well.
Pigalle.
You know. Pigalle, of course. I mean, prostitution was a huge business of the time. You can imagine you've got troops coming from...
The journey between Montmartre and Pigalle is well-travelled, isn't it?
Indeed.
You go see Mother Mary, then you go and see Mother Hubbard.
That's right.
In her cupboard.
Yeah. I'm trying to be polite.
But isn't it incredible? We sit here today in 2016 and we're on the Escape Pod, which is our travel show. And we take it for granted that so many of us who have an Australian passport, Australian citizens, it's been distilled down to us to travel. And we do so with gay abandon.
Mm. Especially on this show.
It's amazing, isn't it, to think that from those experiences, for the people who came back, for the messages that got home, it must have enticed and encouraged people to go themselves.
Indeed. And
in a non-war capacity.
Yes, but also it was a really sort of important and convenient topic for the soldiers because it's easy to talk about your travel experience back to your family back home. It's a lot harder to talk about your war experience and about the daily reality.
Even, well, you don't even have the words sometimes to describe it.
Well, exactly, exactly. So
that's
what
a very good point.
What you find in correspondence or even in personal diaries is a lot of touristic description, marveling at the landscape, marveling at what they discover in various cities. And also sometimes you've got this kind of funny outlook on the war, like they could look and describe about what they can see, you know, far away in the trenches and the light of the explosion. Mm. And they almost describe it as a theater of war. Because we've got to remember it's a modern warfare and that's new to them as well. So those planes fighting in the skies, the lights.
You didn't see that in Wagga Wagga.
Most definitely.
In 1914, you don't see a lot of that in Wagga Wagga.
How do people actually get access to the exhibition?
Yes, yeah, well, it's a free
practically,
exhibition.
How do people find somewhere in France, okay, in the University of Melbourne?
You need to come on campus.
In Parkville?
In Parkville. And you need to go to the Bellevue Library, which is the main library on campus.
Delightfully French-named... The Bellevue family, yeah?
Yeah, Bellevue, but Bellevue, that's how we said.
Bellevue?
At the Bellevue.
That's right.
Maya?
And you go on the first floor, and this is where it is. It opens at 10 a.m. In the morning during weekdays. I think it closes at 5, and it's free for, you know,
and
anyone
on the weekends,
interested.
Is it open?
It's open on weekends as well. I think the opening hours are a bit more restricted. I think it's opened at 11 in the morning. It might close at 4 or 5.
What's the website so people can...
Well, you can go on a library website or you can...
The Bellevue Library website.
Yes, yep. Or you can go on... If you type somewhere in France, Melbourne University, you will find it.
And one of the phrases you used earlier is the soldier as tourist. Mm. So it really explores how they lived and loved and ate and fell in love and explored and learned about France and fell in love, obviously. Do you know of any stories of soldiers staying or marrying and...
Well, you know, there are many records of soldiers that actually came back to Australia with an English bride or even with young children. So at the time of repatriation, because the war ended in 1918, as we know, in November, but... you know, the logistic behind bringing all those men back was quite huge.
Yeah, of course.
So quite a few of them stayed until 1919 and they had plenty of time to meet lovely young ladies. So you have lots of stories about English brides. Now, from the French point of view, we have not been able to really... I mean, I'm sure there were many stories. There's no doubt about that. But stories where actually a soldier came back with a bride, again, I'm sure it would have happened, but it's probably not as common as it would have been with families back in Great Britain.
Of course, because the language thing would have been a problem and, and just culturally. And also how many French men were lost in the First World War.
Well, yes, of course. I mean, the devastation was real for everyone. I mean, France was on its knees by the time. Really, all nation and Germany as well.
Correct.
It was a country that was left to be rebuilt. And when you can really see that even in a testimony when soldiers write or contribute to trench magazines, where you can actually see that, you know, the prototypical sort of characters in those trench magazines are the madame, the one that we're looking at after the estaminet, the mademoiselle, and then you've got the old men or the young children, because all the men were absent, they were gone.
And they were fighting,
and
if they weren't dead, yeah.
Deanne, just a question, and this is left field and you might not have an answer or you just might have an opinion on it. The gay men from Australia that fought, what do you have anything in the archives or history about them?
No, I have actually no idea. Mm-hmm. Those men would have been incorporated, and maybe at the time it's probably something you might not have disclosed anyway. I mean, you were part of...
It would have been illegal.
Yes.
And you would have been court-martialed.
That's right. Yep. So if it's a story, that is definitely a story that is not told.
Not told, yeah.
And there's nothing that seems to be coded in any of the correspondence. I mean, I know sometimes, you know, it depended on the way that you put the stamp on the envelope was enough... The angle was enough to tell someone a message.
Right.
Was there anything like that, do you think, in that era?
Oh, well, it's not something I've really explored as such. I mean, you had the green envelope, and it was called that, which was an envelope where you were allowed to actually send a letter to a loved one. And this letter was meant not to be opened because quite often, of course, the censorship was there. And so correspondence was open to make sure you weren't giving away important information that could fall in the hands of the enemy. So you had a system of envelope, and it was a form of reward almost, where soldiers were able to have a sense of privacy. We do have in the archive, actually, one of those green envelopes, but it's only the envelope. The content is gone. So
So the privacy still remains eternity.
That's correct.
Incredible. It must be time then, because Russ is getting fidgety, which means it must be time.
Oh, he's boiling up to a froth, is he? It's Russ's rant. Oh, we get a drum roll, Russ.
We've got the drum roll happening. It's all happening today.
I think we've got a special effect for that.
Oh, I think we'll need to find one. We need a ranting special effect.
A ranting queen.
Look, I am going to have a quick chat today. Not a long, long chat. I am a ranting queen. Thank you very much for that. Look, I had some friends who flew down after post-Mardi Gras on Monday, Tuesday this week, and they were sitting in a chair on a jet coming home.
They're in a plane.
A plane. We'll call it a plane.
Yep. All right.
It was Tiger, so we will try to call it a plane. The plane took off. Thank you. That's a great special effect. I like that one. The plane took off, and the second it was airborne and the ding had gone off, the seats in front of them came down, bang.
Uh-oh.
Now, I'll tell you what, I'm over that.
Let's get ready to rumble!
I am totally over that. What is it?
Pointing on.
What is it for one single hour people can't hold their chairs up in the upright position? Can you tell me any thoughts? Why do you need to push your chair back?
No, unless if I turn left on a plane and it's not going to affect anyone behind me.
But we don't for an hour flight. It's a shuttle flight, and people should be able to have the manners and the decorum to sit up and just be decent for an hour.
It's called airline etiquette.
Yeah, especially if it's a day flight. If it's an evening flight to Perth, 3 hours, and it's overnight.
Melbourne-Sydney shuttle. In fact, I don't think they should let the seats recline.
No, I've never reclined on it.
Just put super glue in them so they just bloody well don't for those flights.
It's insane. It's insane.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it's awful.
Now, my other rant this week is, what is it with people who go overseas and come back and they don't put on any weight? Hello? The minute I touch down in France, I have eaten every piece of French food I can get my hands on. I'm not going to have time for yoga. I'm not going to have time to go to the gym. I'm going to put on 25 kilos.
But you don't.
25
kilos. No, come on, that's not true, because you're doing a lot more walking.
No,
and,
I don't know.
And you're not as sedentary as you are in your day job. So you can have a few extra calories because you're looking for the restaurant and a bit more adrenaline's going. And we know that burns calories.
And you're fueled by vin rouge.
That's right. So what's the problem?
Well, I'm not going to go to Europe and eat celery sticks and carrot. I can't.
I'm not asking you to. I'm going to say go to Europe and do some walking.
No, I just won't have it. My partner's a stick. I'm a round girl. I will eat anything when I'm on holidays. That's it. I'm not going to. There's no rules. When you're overseas, there are no rules.
The thing is, Diane is here. I think she might share with you some of the secrets that French women have to stay thin.
Well, that's a myth. Sorry.
You could have written the book, French Women Don't Get Fat.
Yes, that's right. But, you know, that's one of those fascinations with, you know, the way we go about things. But, yeah.
You're very modest.
So you're just going to have to sniff the foie gras and not
eat? No, I can't do it. My body is telling me to eat, consume, diet when you get home.
Okay.
Yep. And I can't do that. What's that other thing that I've heard people do? They do the 2 days
moderation
on and the 1 day off. No.
Oh yeah, that's easy.
Yeah. And alcohol. I mean, French champagne. What's that all about as well? You can't.
Yeah, they do other things too.
Yeah, I know. I just don't get it.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.